Welcome to It's Bloody Complicated, powered by Compass. I'm your host, Neil Lawson. These are unprecedented times and we need to rise to the enormous challenges we now face, from the economy, climate change, to the state of our democracy and politics worldwide. This is the space to jump into the deep end and embrace the complexity. This podcast lets us hear from and question the best writers, thinkers, politicians, journalists and activists to share their vision, ideas and campaigns to build a good society, one that is much more equal, sustainable and democratic. It's Bloody Complicated is supported by our Compass members. If you'd like to gain access to live discussions and raise direct questions to our guests, join us and support our work. You can register at compassonline.org.uk/podcast to become a Compass member and join the next podcast. But for now, just sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of It's Bloody Complicated. On this issue of It's Bloody Complicated, we'd be delighted to be joined by Peter Kellner, veteran pollster. I'm not sure if Peter's going to like that. Experienced pollster and journalist. Look back at the local elections last week and forward to what they mean for the next general election. Peter's been a reporter on Newsnight, was political editor of The New Statesman, writes everywhere, and was president of YouGov. Let's read the tea leaves with Peter. We're also really delighted to be joined by two councillors from areas where Compass local groups were active to give us a flavour of what happened last week and how cooperation actually worked on the ground. So we're hoping that Caroline Jackson is going to be able to join us, who's the leader of Lancaster City Council over the last 2 years and has led a shared administration there. And we have got, thankfully, Elizabeth Dennis-Harbour, who leads the Labour group in a partnership with the Liberal Democrats in North Hertfordshire, who both the Liberal Democrats and Labour did better last year. So we're looking forward to hearing from Elizabeth and hopefully Caroline about what happened last week. These elections might be the last big vote before a general election. They really matter, and the Compass has been working hard under the radar, building the base for cooperation locally. Peter, let's start with, as we always do with our guests, just tell us where are you so we can locate you physically, and tell us how are you?
I'm in North London. I'm fine. I'm off to Ghana on the weekend, so I had to get my malaria tablets and my yellow fever vaccine documents. Fine.
Good. Okay. Pia, you've written about it a bit already, but you've probably got some more thoughts and deeper thoughts. Give us your overview about what you think happened last Thursday.
Look, in terms of the sort of big national picture, it was terrible for the Conservatives and just about okay for Labour. Pretty good for the Lib Dems, pretty good for the Greens, although I see they've been kicked out of control in Brighton, although they've gained a council in Mid-Suffolk and gained, a couple of hundred seats around the country, which is really good for the Greens. In terms of the extrapolation to national vote share, there are two such exercises, one by the BBC, put Labour 9 points ahead of the Conservatives, the other by Colin Rannings and Michael Thrasher, put Labour 7 points ahead. So they agree that it's, a high single-digit lead, which in a general election probably gives Labour just about an overall majority. I'm assuming some tactical voting. I'm assuming that Labour will make some inroads into the SNP support in Scotland. The good news for Labour is that local elections tend to understate Labour's national support and overstate Lib Dem and Green. In other words, it gets the progressive votes about right, but as I think it's fairly obvious looking around the country, in a number of places, people will vote Lib Dem or Green locally, and then we'll vote Labour in Tory Labour marginals in a general election. So these figures are pretty consistent with opinion polls putting Labour 12 to 15 points ahead, something like that, which is where recent polls have been. The bad news for Labour is that it's still basically mid-term in terms of the way voters think about elections. We're still in a protest mood. A lot of Tories are staying at home, whether you look at by-elections or local elections. In the polls, one of the reasons why the Tories are low is because a lot of people who voted Tory last time now say they don't know how they would vote. On past experience, you'd expect most of them to vote in a general election and for most of them to vote, go back and vote Conservative. It may be different this time. So bottom line, Labour is on course to win the election in the sense of Keir Starmer becoming Prime Minister. It's touch and go in my mind as to whether Labour will have an overall majority.
And I read somewhere, Peter, that on average, governments recover 6 to 18 months out by about 8% on average before a general election. Does that ring true with you? And do you suspect that that's likely to happen this time?
8% in terms of the gap between the parties or the actual share of the vote going, 8 points sounds plausible in terms of the extent to which the gap will close. It sounds a bit high if you're saying that is what support for the party of government will achieve. But if we reckon that Labour's truly now is, let's say around 14 points, okay, let's sort of give a middle point, then if you say yeah, then you'd expect Labour to win the next election with a popular vote lead of around 6 points. I'm not saying that's a prediction. It doesn't sound ridiculous. At the moment, I think Labour would do very, very well to have a double-digit lead, but I think they have to do very badly not to get at least the middle single digits. And maybe one other point is that come the general election, the big numerical question on the night, really, is how many pro-Tory MPs there will be and how many anti-Tory MPs there will be. Now, the only non-Tory MPs who are likely at all to vote with the Conservatives, and even that's not certain, are the Democratic Unionists in Northern Ireland. It'll be maybe six or seven of them. So the Conservatives, in my mind, need to get to around 315 seats for any chance of staying in office. And if you take just the crude figures put out after the local elections by Sky and the BBC, actually, what you're looking at is anti-Tory MPs in the high 300s and pro-Tory MP in the low to middle 200s. In other words, even if Labour doesn't get an overall majority, there will be a very large anti-Tory majority at the next election, which is why I'm pretty sure Keir Starmer will be Prime Minister. Whether Labour will have an overall majority, whether even the Labour will be the largest party, that's less certain. But there's a huge anti-Tory-Tory gap that has to close before Rishi Sunak has any real prospects of remaining Prime Minister after the election.
So I think it's interesting tonight, fresh news, is that Starmer refused to rule out a coalition with the Liberal Democrats seven times in a BBC interview tonight. I mean, despite the fact that over the weekend we're treating Peter Carl, et cetera, were all saying that there will be a Labour majority and they won't talk to anyone. So that sounds like a bit of backtracking. Do you think that's wise, sensible kind of backtracking on leaving that door open?
As I understand it, what Keir Starmer said, I'm not going to answer hypothetical questions. So he's giving a non-answer rather than a possible conclusion. I think here's the problem. The sense after the election of a new relationship between Labour and the Lib Dems of any kind, formal or informal, will depend a lot on the numbers. So if Labour's at 310 seats and the Lib Dems are at 30 or 40, then you have the prospect that if you have some arrangement with the Lib Dems, Labour, even though it's short of a majority, could run for a whole four or five-year parliamentary term if it has some type of relationship with the Lib Dems. If Labour's on 270 or 280 and the Lib Dems are on 30, then together they don't have a majority, then I think it's a very, very different ballgame, because I think the only way it makes any sense to have any form of relationship with the Lib Dems if together they have a solid parliamentary majority. And even then, you know, I think the Lib Dems wouldn't go into formal coalition. I think that's the one remaining residue of what happened in 2010. So you'd be looking at something less formal, confidence and supply, or possibly the kind of thing that you had in the late 70s when you had the Lib-Lab Pact, and then you had before the 97 election, when you had all these working groups between Labour and the Lib Dems you know, the Cook-McLennan Pact, if anybody remembers that far back. So there is a history of different kinds of conversation between Labour and the Liberal Democrats. Well, if there's a conversation in the context of there being a clear Lib-Lab majority, then I think it may well happen. If they're short together of a clear overall majority, it's different.
And what do you think about, I mean, the Greens did very well last week. I mean, the Labour strategists will be thinking that they can squeeze the Liberal, the Green vote, I mean, and the Liberal Democrat vote in the right places, but particularly the Green vote. I mean, and Compass is, you know, equally Green, Liberal Democrat and, you know, and Labour. I mean, how squeeze? I mean, do you think that the Green vote in particular is as squeezable as it has been in the past? In particular, if Labour keeps away from PR, you know, doesn't say that it's going to kind of reverse the process bill, you know, it isn't firm enough on the 28 billion per year on green investment, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And as that kind of cosmopolitan, you know, city, you know, university educated cohort. I mean, do you think that there's a chance that, you know, the progressive vote could be, you know, badly split? But not for the Greens, because it's a good thing if lots of people vote Greens, I'm sure, as Caroline will say.
Right. Here's the thing. What Labour's banking on is in the seats that really matter, i.e. Tory-held seats where the majority is 4,000 or 5,000 or 6,000. In other words, the ones that Labour really needs to win, if either get a majority or come close to a majority, they're banking on the people who are basically sympathetic to the Lib Dems, basically sympathetic to the Greens, to realise they would be wasting their votes if they didn't vote Labour. And if they really want to kick the Tories out, they have to vote Labour in those seats. Now, my judgment is it's not an all or nothing judgment. I think a lot of people in those seats will vote Labour as their second choice in order to kick the Tories out, but not all of them will. And if you look at the polling data, the impression I get is there are a lot of particularly younger voters in their 20s, early 30s, people who've never been in the past historically tribally Labour, who because of green issues, because of Brexit and Labour's particular position or non-position on the EU, I think there will be in those key seats, you will still get, you know, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 people voting Lib Dem or Green, despite it being a marginal Tory Labour seat. Because although they don't like the Tories, they are not so enthused by Labour that they'll cast the tactical vote. And this might mean Labour failing to pick up 10, 20, 30 seats that they would otherwise win. So it's not an all or nothing. Labour's task is to maximise tactical voting, we'll see how that comes out.
And what was your impression? It's hard to know what exactly happened. There was quite a lot of talk at the end of, you know, so Compass has been doing all of this tactical campaigning, trying to ensure that people stood where they could win and campaign and focus where they could win and not where they were going to stop other progressives. And we're fairly clear that that worked where it was organised, but either through us or spontaneously in many places on the ground, because people are much more aware. But in terms of tactical voting, that took off in a bit of a flurry towards the end from the Forward Democracy website Stop the Tories. Do you think it had much of an impact, or I mean, and how can we find out, Peter, if it did have an impact?
I don't know. You know, so much, so many questions of these kinds, Neil. What you want is a doppelganger, another Britain somewhere else, where they had exactly the same elections and there was no tactical campaigning. I mean, you can compare the two, but you know, it's politics and social science. You never have the opportunity to conduct those kinds of experiments that you can in physics or in chemistry. So, and what I would say is that there's now quite a lot of it. We saw it in the by-elections in Wakefield, and then the ones the Liberals gained in Chesham, in Shropshire, down in Devon. There was clearly lots of tactical voting there. My impression from the polling is there's the preconditions for tactical voting, which didn't exist in 2019. The problem in 2019 is that Lib Dems didn't want to vote for Jeremy Corbyn, and Labour couldn't see the point in voting for Joe Swinson. Whereas in 97, a lot of Lib Dems were happy with Tony Blair, and a lot of Labour people were happy with Paddy Ashdown. So I think we're back to much more like the 90s than 4 years ago, in the sense that, there's not the preconditions for tactical voting are there. The only other thing I'd say is 2019 was also, the picture was queer by the fact there were four or five, I think, competing tactical voting websites, and they didn't all agree with each other. So although in general I like, you know, the interplay of open competition, I think on the whole I'd quite like to see a monopoly of one single dominant tactical voting operation, and perhaps there's some conversations to be had with all the different kinds of people who might do it, so that people don't say, well, I'm confused because, you know, in Finchley or Kensington or whatever, this site says vote Lib Dem, that site says vote Labour. We need to avoid that.
Thankfully, the pitch is much clearer than it was in 2019, not least because Labour did so well, and there's kind of one bit of competition between Labour and the Liberal Democrats in Sheffield. But I'm always minded that those things don't work in the Greens' favour, you know, and that's why we're going to come back to a little bit of a conversation with you about PR. So just leave us for a minute, Peter, with kind of, when do you think the election's going to be, and you know, stick your neck out about what you think the result's going to be. We won't hold you to it.
Okay, I think it'll be late autumn next year, unless the polls show a clear Conservative lead well before them. I don't expect that to happen. They could theoretically go to January 25, but I think everybody would be appalled by the thought of a campaign going on through Christmas. So I think, you know, October, November next year. There's one thing, now others may be correct me, I know it's true this year, I think it's true next year, that the historic pattern of the Tories having the last party conference is now over, at least over for this year, and the last party conference is Labour. So if you're Rishi Sunak, would you prefer to put the contest back with the risk that, as well, Labour's conference is the last thing that voters will be aware of, or would you prefer to make sure that, would you prefer for the conferences not to be held, so you call the election, you dissolve the parliament in September and have an October election, but I leave the others with more Machiavellian cast of mind than I to work through that.
Good tactical question. Thanks for that. We'll come back to you in a bit. So over to Caroline Elizabeth now. So Caroline, do you want to start and just tell us, you know, what happened in your neck of the woods? What, you know, what went on and why?
Well, a very interesting result in that we as Greens went up from the 10 that we had last 4 years ago to 21 this time, which was excellent. We had acquired some defections in between and some by-elections, but some of those people didn't stay on, they retired. So we had made a notable increase, and we took some of those, five of those were Conservative held country parish type areas. So not where we as Lancaster Greens expect to collect seats. Alongside that, Labour did very well in the Morecambe area, and they ended up with 24 members, so slightly more than us. And the independent vote, which had been high last election, actually dropped hugely, picked up a bit by Lib Dems. So Lib Dems also acquired some country seats from Conservatives and some in Morecambe. So the situation is not clear at all. There's all the possibilities you can have are arranged. None of them are clear. The kingmakers, if you like, are probably the Liberal Democrat group, and everybody is really worried about next year's budget. So having thoughts about where do we want to be in terms of actually taking the blame for that budget. So quite a difficult situation.
And how much cross-party, you know, under the radar collaboration was there that you can tell us about, if you can tell us anything?
When you say was there, do you mean?
Yeah, I mean, how much did you, you know, did you leave each other alone? Did you focus on certain areas? Did you put your, you know, resources where they could, you know, work best?
Yes, I think there was a certain amount of it. None of it that is done above, you know, openly. It's more about we all have limited resources and we use them to the best of our ability. We targeted certain seats, definitely Libs, Dems and Labour did that as well. And whilst we actually did manage to stand a full slate, which is the first time ever Others didn't stand the full slate. Okay. So yes, people husbanded their resources fairly well. I think the independents lost out there because some of their seats were being fought over, and therefore they had in fact the least power in this situation.
We'll come back in a bit. Elizabeth, over to you. What happened in North Hertfordshire?
So since 2019, Labour and the Liberal Democrats have operated as a joint administration in North Herts, with Labour being the biggest party. At each subsequent election since then, we've both made sort of small gains, increasing the number of councillors we've got. And this year, we went into the election knowing that there was the probability we would be making gains again, but we've also got to have an eye to 2024, because we're changing from having elections by thirds to having all-out elections in 2024. So there's a bit of groundwork that needs to start being done there. And if we're casting forward tactically and thinking about how we can ensure progressives really are the majority parties in this local authority, we need to start the groundwork now. So the results came through, and Labour gained two seats in two of our targets, which we anticipated. We came very close to winning a third, and were just held back by a 28-year incumbent who carried a personal vote. And if anybody wants to drop in the chat how they've managed to overcome that factor of the personal vote, I think a lot of politicians would be very happy to hear about that. The Lib Dems also made two gains in their two targets. We're incredibly fortunate that we don't tend to compete against each other in North Herts. And what we've done is target our wards based on where we know our support is, where we've got those very strong second place results coming through year after year. And we've done that consistently since I first ran back in 2015, and had that consistent sort of small drip gain and working and growing and building those seats up. So we're now in the position that Labour is the largest party on the council. The Lib Dems are a very good solid second, and we've pushed the Conservatives down to a historic low number of just 15 councillors in a 49 district councillor area in the heart of the Blue Wall. So I'm quite pleased with that.
And there, is it kind of covert, over, or just natural political geography that you don't compete?
I think it's been the natural political geography. So when you look at Hitchin, for example, as one of our four main urban centres, that is very much a strong, solid Labour vote. When it comes through locally, that's been helped and bolstered by some really great groundwork that's been done for the last 30 or 40 years by a number of our Labour councillors. Parliamentary picture has been skewed because of the constituency being in with Harpenden, but with new boundaries, that could potentially change and open up some different arguments. I'm not going to talk about bar charts in this space. In the Lib Dem side of things, they tend to have a stronger vote in areas like Royston, which is closer to Cambridge, and we all know sort of and aware of the political geography in that space. There was one ward where we decided this year to sort of test the water, because it's been kind of, we felt that the data indicated it could be a three-way split, and we wanted to see and test ahead of a general election what might happen there, because that falls into the Stevenage constituency. And what the data this year showed was that actually that place is a three-horse race. There's a 46, 33 and 26% vote split between the three main parties. And that was with a Labour candidate that didn't have very much resource behind him, just going out and identifying who the Labour voters are and what those messages are. And that's positive for us, because it means that we've got data on a segment of the community we didn't know about before. We've heard their opinions and their views, and we can feed that through to our Lib Dem councillor that holds that ward, and make sure that progressively we are actually linking up and supporting people in our community, whereas that type of conversation simply doesn't happen between the Conservatives and the other parties.
Very good to hear. And just to both of you, I mean, if the polls continue to close, and, you know, all the talk is of some kind of, you know, balanced, I don't like the term, hung parliament, there'll be the accusations of coalition of chaos. You've both been successfully working with other parties. Do you want to just say a quick word about why and how that's worked? I mean, I'm sure there are problems and difficulties, but, you know, what have you learned from that experience?
Yeah, interesting. Just reflecting on what Elizabeth was saying, that we have, out of a 61-member council, we now have five Conservatives and four independents. So sort of in terms of the progressive parties, quite a move. But the interesting thing is independents, having been in the shared administration with us, are much more progressive, I think, than they were when they first started. So interesting that they move as well. our situation has been, yes, five parties within the administration, and ranging from independents, Lib Dem, Labour, ourselves, and
more like Borgen than British politics, isn't it?
Yeah. So, and one of those parties, the independent party, split as well during the administration, and we kept them together within the administration. I think the big thing I learned was you must have a solid agreed foundation. So we had agreed priorities, and then beneath the priorities, we had agreed statements of strategies. And once we had those, it made it much easier to proceed. Whichever party you were in, you were working towards those. And we also had a set of 19 agreed priorities, that things that we all wanted to do together. And those were informed by all of our memberships. So by doing that, each portfolio holder was actually supported by knowing that other portfolio holders wanted the same thing. And we did have good cooperation in trying to achieve all of those. Sometimes it can be nice to have a little battle against the officers. We've got these priorities. We're all going to make sure they happen, and sort of aligning up together in order to achieve what we want to achieve. Very hyper-local, though. It's all local stuff.
Sure.
It's making the best of our own local resources. And I think I learned that you've got to keep that local focus and make sure that you work on that, and also that you apportion the praise so that everybody gets, whatever group they come from, they get the praise for all of what we achieve. Obviously, afterwards, then everybody goes away and says they did it on their own. But at least during it, everybody feels that they want to achieve it. And it was a very positive experience. And I think it was a positive experience in the end for our officers as well.
Okay. Well, I hope it continues to be a positive experience, and that you can, you know, galvanise those progressive forces in Lancaster again, as you've done in the past. So good luck with that. How does it work for you, Elizabeth, in North Hertfordshire?
So similar to Caroline, we've got an agreement between ourselves and the Liberal Democrats. But helpfully, I'm only working with one other party. I have no idea how those leaders who are working across a rainbow coalition hold everybody together with competing views, and absolutely all credit to leaders like Caroline for the work that they do. So again, our agreement is based on shared priorities, because there's a lot more that we have in common with each other than the things that divide us. So we have conversations around what our manifesto commitments and pledges were, how we can implement that, and loop in with our officers as well about what is going to be deliverable. We've had the benefit of refining things over a period now of 4 years. So I think we're in quite a positive place this year as we enter negotiations with the Liberal Democrats that we work with. We've got very few changes that we need to make, and we've set a corporate plan for the council as well that's based on the priorities in our joint administration agreement, that has a medium to long-term view. So those priorities that we have as partners are enshrined as part of what the council's vision is going to be going forward. The projects that we're working on are joint projects, and within cabinet, for each cabinet portfolio holder that we have, there's a deputy of the opposite party, so that our members are supported in terms of doing their day jobs, because as district councillors, a lot of us do have other jobs and other commitments outside of politics. So sometimes to get the work done, it's nice to have support. But it also in the early days helps to act as a sort of check and balance, to build the relationships, to build the trust, to build the confidence, and meant that everybody had a stake in all of those portfolios. And we were able to sort of bond together and build relationships. And some of those portfolios have changed hands from Labour to Lib Dem or Lib Dem to Labour, as well as we've gone through the years and identified the talent across that broader pool of councillors that we have access to form an administration. So that's quite important as well. I think especially if you're a majority group that doesn't necessarily have a large majority in an overall control place, you can soon run out of places of people to put in places. So having that broader pool of talent and being able to put the right people in the right jobs, I think has really, really helped North Hearts and deliver positive outcomes.
Fantastic. See, it doesn't have to be coalitions of chaos. It can be coalitions of coherence, stability, transformation, everything. You've just got to kind of treat people with respect. Thanks for that both. And just back to you, Peter, just on that, on the, you know, one of the central questions for Compass for progressive politics is the issue of proportional representation. The case I made in The Guardian today is that that's the kind of glue that locks together the old politics. And if you can get rid of that, then you can open up the new. You know, you've been thinking about this and looking at it for a long time. Tell us where you've got to in terms of the issue of electoral reform.
I've never been, until recently, in support of anything close to a proportional system. I've long wanted the system that was voted down in the referendum about 12 years ago, the alternative votes. But I changed my mind because it does seem to me that if you have a system which makes it very hard for anybody to break into the two-party duopoly, and that duopoly throws up, you know, Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn as the fundamental choice, this is a broken system. I'm not a strong enthusiast for any particular system. What I mean is any electoral system has advantages and disadvantages, in my view. A general election has essentially three functions. One is to represent the range of views across the country. The second is to choose a government. And the third is to represent individual communities. And your choice of system depends to a large extent on how you prioritize those three things. You can't do all three things perfectly. You've got to decide which is more important. Is it a clear choice of government? Is it proportional views? Is it community representation? But I think we need to move towards a more proportional system. The one thing, though, if I may, Neil, your Guardian piece, which I recommend if they've not read it, everybody reads, because I think it's really interesting. I'm not sure. You give the impression, you don't say this, but that if there were a proportional system and you had, you know, three or four progressive parties, each getting 10 to 20% of the votes, after the election, they would come together, hold hands and sing Kumbaya. But that's not how multi-party politics works. Israel, which has the purest of all proportional systems, has a sulfurous relationship between the parties after elections. It is awful. And so, you know, I don't think one should be starry-eyed. If there were to be a proportional system, and you were then, as a result, to have, you know, a 50 or 100 seat overall majority for three or four progressive parties, you know, a mixture of Marxists, Greens, Liberals and Social Democrats, it might be quite messy afterwards. And also, of course, you might then get the far right having a real toehold in parliaments, which we've not really had in the past. So all I would say is, yeah, let's explore PR, but be careful what you wish for.
Yeah. Well, I do wish for it, and I don't think it's a panacea at all, Peter, but I do think it unlocks the potential progressive majority that exists in our country. And anyway, we'd have people like Caroline and Elizabeth running our parties who would know how to work together in a harmonious way.
Hello, Samuel here from the Compass office. I hope you're enjoying the discussion so far. It's Bloody Complicated is brought to you by Compass, and it's made possible by the support of our amazing members, like Eliza. Here's Eliza on why she joined the Compass community.
My name is Eliza. I've been a Compass member for about 3 or 4 years, I think. What drew me to Compass was the fact that it's cross-party and it's also not a party. I had a light bulb moment about elections, which was no one's going to win except the Tories under this system, and we have to work together. Having been previously a member of the Labour Party and then joining the Green Party, I really wanted to see parties working together, and we have people that are politicians, MPs, trade union leaders, etc. And it's quite level. There's no big hierarchy. It's quite an honest, open space where people come together. You will hear from people from all around the political spectrum actually debating the hard stuff. It's actually, let's find a solution to the problems that we have and let's do it together. We need this progressive alliance. And I would like to see people who are passionate about getting the Tories out in the next election and getting proportional representation in. Come and join Compass now and actually swell the movement, because without people, there's no power. And that's what we need right now.
Find out more about joining the Compass community at compassonline.org.uk/podcast. And now, back to the discussion.
Let's get some other people into this and get some questions on to our three wonderful panellists.
Yes, hi there. Good evening, everyone. So we have Doug here to raise this question. Right. Hi, Samuel. Hi, everyone. Yeah, I mean, basically, I'm increasingly struggling to see Labour as a progressive party. I'm hoping that Starmer is, you know, just keeping his, playing his cards close to his chest pre-election. But on things like Brexit and, you know, repealing, you know, protest legislation. But he seems to be digging his heels in very hard, despite the constituency Labour Party's vote, the public vote, the trade union support for proportional representation of some form. My question is, what can we do to exert pressure on Labour to get PR onto their manifesto for the next election? Because otherwise, I have a horrible feeling it's going to be a lost opportunity. And to be quite honest, I think if Labour don't adopt it, there's a chance that we will end up with just a one-term Labour government.
Thank you very much, Doug. And we have now Eliza. Eliza, do you want to come in?
Yeah, thank you. And hi, everybody. So, yeah, my question is pretty straightforward, really, but related to a bit to what Doug's saying, because it's about this fact that Starmer's backtracking on PR. So he did support it in the run-up to his leadership election, which made me very happy. Now he's backtracked. My friends who support, my Labour-supporting friends or Starmer-supporting friends, shall we say, because now Labour has got its own splits developing, shall we say, they say, oh, give him a chance. He is playing his cards close to his chest. He needs to be very careful. My fear is that if we can't find a way to motivate Greens at a local level, the Green Party, Green activists, to work as part of an alliance for the general election, we're not going to get what we need from this alliance. Greens, traditionally, they are more squeezed because as soon as the Lib Dems start winning seats, like in the local election, somehow the Greens do get squeezed out. I try and make the argument to my friends in the local Green Party, but they're becoming increasingly tribal, and that's mainly because they've been shafted a lot in the past by Labour. So I'm struggling really to find a way to motivate Greens like me and to say, look, this is what we can do. This is positive. So, yeah, that's my question.
Thank you very much, Eliza. And lastly, we had a question from Titus. He said, do you think proportional representation will improve UK politics? And if so, which system do you recommend? And what will it take to persuade Keir Starmer to back it?
So mostly this is about PR. And obviously, we're strong supporters of PR. And having worked that amazingly difficult five-party group, I kind of think can see how PR could work. Difficult, but in the end, possibly taking the energy towards doing things instead of shouting at each other, which is, if we're ever going to do the climate change necessary, I think we have to go there. As far as getting Greens in to back Labour, I think the one big thing that might move us would be if Labour were to agree to some step downs. That is, you know, we want to get Labour. Labour wants to get it wants the vote. It wants to get majority, but we have only one MP, and it wouldn't take many step downs, I think, for us for the Greens to feel right. We are part of this at the moment. As Eliza was saying, it feels very much as though we are pushed to fight our own corner, and people with a serious concern about the climate are becoming more and more desperate. And this is part of the reason why you're not talking into a straightforward political setup. I think that's really important to understand. I'd also say there's a very interesting thing that's happened with young people, particularly students, as a result of the ID situation. So students have really organised themselves to keep their vote. We're knocking on doors of students who are thoroughly organised and getting themselves to vote, whereas in the past, they didn't seem to care. But they basically have said to themselves, we're going to lose our power here, and we're not having it taken off us. And I think they are those non-aligned groups who could make quite a difference to where the vote falls.
Elizabeth, do you want to go next?
Yes, thank you. Gosh, what type of PR? I think the Jenkins report was a great place to start, but that is significantly out of date. It's almost 30 years old now, isn't it? So we'd have to start from square one and decide, was that the right output? Is there something that's different? Everybody's going to have their own view. And for goodness sake, if we're going to review the type of PR that we go to, let's keep the self-interested political noise and bias out of that space, because that is never going to return a democratic result. On the Labour policy issues around PR, Labour Party conference in Liverpool last year passed a motion supporting PR being part of the party's next general election manifesto. So the constituency Labour parties are behind it, activists are behind it, the majority of unions are behind it now. Of course, recommendations and motions passed at conference are not binding on the party executive. So, you know, if members from other parties know Labour Party members who are currently sitting in CLP meetings and thinking about national policy issues and the motions we want to have at this year's party conference, talk to us, put pressure on us, because there will be motions going forward to try and make sure that PR is something that the party takes forward. Because at the end of the day, first past the post no longer works in a multi-party system. And we know that there isn't such a thing as a coalition of chaos unless you allow that to occur. We are working in local government as a local government family, really quite happily with those progressive parties where we share values. And it's all about identifying the things that matter most to your communities and working together where you can come together, while also respecting and valuing other people's positions on certain aspects. A lot of us all want the same outcome, which is the best thing for our communities. The one thing that we tend to disagree with a lot of the time can be the journey. And it's about deciding, well, is this a hill to die on? Or is this a compromise that, we are able to make as sensible, mature adults, which as local politicians, as national politicians, I hope that we are. Don't necessarily always see that from Westminster, though. In terms of queries around activists supporting each other cross-party, if I comment on that in this space publicly, I will be thrown out of my party. So I will leave that to others to work out and to figure out sensible and supportive ways forward so that we can all come together and serve our communities in the best possible way.
Go on, Peter.
I think the system, Blair's narrow head, I like, is the Irish system with one exception, right? That is a multi-member seats, 3, 4, 5 members, and then you have a single transferable vote within it. The exception is, I think, the Irish system of voters choosing which candidate from each party they put first is catastrophic, because it leads to the worst form of localised pork barrel politics. This should be about electing, you know, a national parliament. So I would do what we used to have in European elections, which you have a single transferable vote with parties, and it's the parties that nominate the order. And I know this will offend people who like that kind of micro choice. All I'm saying is, look at actually what happens in Ireland rather than the theory of choice. And I don't think we want that. Look, Alan's point, Labour standing down, it's not going to happen. I mean, maybe it should, but it isn't going to happen. And in the past, it hasn't mattered. Back in 97, for example, and there are other examples, the one I know about, is that basically the Labour Party, Labour and Liberal parties in Hove and Lewis got together. And they basically agreed, they put up paper candidates in both seats. But Lewis, which was a Lib Dem target, all the Labour members in Lewis would work in Hove, a Labour target, and all the Lib Dem members in Hove would work in Lewis, a Lib Dem target. And it worked. The voters were not denied a choice, but the Tories lost both seats. So whether it's a good idea or not, it isn't going to happen. Let me offer this prospect. If we're going to change the electoral system, your Labour's not going to put it in its next manifesto. Remember that the legislation to change the electoral system must be passed by MPs. And in the case of Labour MPs, if you go straight to a proportional system, then lots of them are voting themselves out of a seat in Parliament. Because in any proper proportional system, Labour would have significantly dozens fewer seats, possibly hundreds fewer seats than under the present system. So the most you'll ever get Labour MPs to vote for enthusiastically is the alternative vote, because that will hurt the Tories, but it will hurt hardly any Labour MPs. It will get you more Lib Dems, it might get you a handful of Greens. Now, if you were to say to me, in 10 years' time, we've moved towards a different vote if this is what's happened, here's my guess as to how it might happen. That there is some sort of Lib-Lab agreement, because Lib-Lab together get a majority in the next parliament, and they both agree to go into the following election with the same promise on the electoral reform, which will have two elements. One is that we will legislate for the alternative votes in the following parliament, and secondly, they will set up a royal commission or a speaker's conference to debate to consider more far-reaching reform and possibly put that to a referendum at the end of the process. I can't actually see any other process that might actually lead to change because, as I say, because you've got to look at what Labour MPs will vote for. And you've also got the problem that we did have a referendum 12 years ago, 2-1 vote against it. So I think you need some kind of explicit electoral legitimacy for any change. And a common manifesto promise by Labour and the Lib Dems at the election after next would give you that democratic legitimacy. So that's my quick and dirty way as to how it might happen, as opposed to the idealistic way of how, if we were in creating a country with a blank sheet of paper, how we might design it from scratch.
And I think, Peter, you know, we'll both remember Tatton in 1997. Labour didn't stand a candidate then. So the principle has been made. And if we're living in a world of kind of, you know, the whiff of authoritarianism, which is put in that Guardian piece, is around the, you know, the possible move to the very hard right politics, obviously climate change. If Labour is staring down the barrel of not being able to win and makes it more likely the Tories will win if they stand everywhere, then what, you know, what is going on then? I mean, what is happening? And I would say to Caroline and Green colleagues on the call, I mean, I would learn the lesson of UKIP. You know, you have to apply pressure. If people aren't going to do what, you know, is sensible and in the national interest, you have to apply pressure. I mean, something has to give, doesn't it, on this?
Of course, you have to apply pressure. Of course, something has to give. Tatton was a one-off. It was exceptional. It was Neil Hamilton, who was, well, I don't know if he's, you know, charged with libel. But shall we say, he was a particularly unsavoury MP. And everybody agreed this was an exception. This never was designed to set a precedent. And you know, if Tatton is your only example, oddly enough, you can go back much longer. In the 1950s, the Tories and the Lib Dems had local pacts in Bolton and I think Huddersfield was a few places in the north of England. They were cities with two seats. The Lib Dems stood down in one in favour of the Tories, the Tories stood down in the other in favour of the Liberals. And indeed, Winston Churchill went to speak for Violet Bonham Carter, who was a Liberal candidate in whichever seat it was. But, you know, that's not happening. And I think the problem is, if you were to do it in a number of seats, then the Labour would be facing the Tory charge, you're depriving people of choice, the media and so on. And the fact of the matter is that when there's an appetite to vote tactically, paper candidates get very few votes. So I think I understand the principle behind standing down, and I understand that at a local level it makes a lot of sense. But I think in a parliamentary general election, I'm not sure the balance of advantage is for the progressives.
Remember 2019, 360-odd Brexit Party candidates got their demands in, got the Tory parties to commit to what they wanted, and then stood down. You know, they do it, the right do it so effectively, and Labour refuses to do it, and it's a big problem. But let's get another bunch of questions in. Samuel?
We will have a question from Sue.
Hello. I actually had two questions, but I think the first one was, what have the panel got to say about the voter photo ID issue? We've heard about the students getting their act together a bit more, but I haven't been able to find much in the way of any data about what the effect has been this time. And I know that the parties were very thankful that the local elections were going to be the trial ground for this for general election. What are the chances of it being, you know, the idea being abolished, although I can't see the Tories doing so? And the other question I had very briefly was about the interesting substantial increase in overall control or hung councils. And we've heard quite a lot about that. But the hung council, you know, those are very good examples for the national system of how to work together.
Excellent. We got a question from Anne.
Hello. Yes, my question, because we're talking about the English local elections, do you think it's worthwhile pursuing PR for local elections in England as a sub-goal towards PR for general elections, particularly as we're the only nation in the UK without this? What lessons should we learn from Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland? Thank you.
Great question, Anne.
Got a last question from Liz.
My other question was to do with the mayoral, the Conservatives changing the mayoral election voting unilaterally. So I wanted to ask the panel if they agree that sets a precedent for future governments to unilaterally change to PR without a referendum.
Good point, Liz.
Absolutely. I think, but in as far as there are disadvantages as a national, like choice of government, it doesn't simply, but, you know, local councils do not have the power to go to war or run the police force or things like that. I think Liz's question at the end, one of the problems is, of course, is if you do get a change in the voting system, and then nevertheless the Tories come back in a future government, they could undo it just as they undid fixed term parliaments. And as they switch, as they said, from mayoral election from supplementary to first past the post. So looking in the undergrowth of this debate is whether we need a written constitution with proper safeguards against a government with a small majority simply undoing all that. But hey, Neil, that's a conversation for another podcast.
Voter ID, I think, is very interesting. What we didn't see many people coming and being turned away because they didn't have their ID. What we did appear to see was a reduced number of people actually coming out to vote in the more deprived wards, and various rumours going around like it costs £13 to get your voter authority. So what we want to look at is what were the numbers in the more deprived wards? Has it made a difference to voter turnout? And can we prove that voter ID is causing that problem? Because there were people who just do not live lives that mean that they've got that ID. So I think that we need more data. I think the questioner said, where's the data? Well, it was collected in polling stations, but we need to look more widely to check on the effect on those who were most likely not to have their ID. I think the idea of going to PR at local and district level is fascinating. Although, take Peter's point that you go one way and you go another way, it would hardly be worth doing, I suppose, if that would happen. But I think for those of us who are on this call, like myself and Elizabeth, we would probably find, whilst that was a bit kind of full on, that would be something that as progressives we would want and would be able to work on in order to create districts that we're doing more for the people we're most concerned about.
Elizabeth, final word.
I'll be very brief. On voter ID, I absolutely agree with Caroline. We need to look at, interrogate that data as soon as it comes back from the Commission. And I know that on polling day, we were talking to people and having conversations. I've got double-digit figures across the district from our doorstep conversations from people who were disenfranchised or because they couldn't obtain the necessary voter ID, didn't have the ID, their entire family on a point of principle decided not to engage with democracy at all. So there's a psychology that's grown up around this. It feels very much to some people that the government is choosing to exclude them, therefore why should they engage? And with growing apathy in our political system, that is incredibly terrible and dangerous. So I think it's a case of let's watch this space. But from the anecdotal conversations and the numbers that we know, having spoken to our polling clerks that were turned away at the polling stations, I would be surprised if there's going to be sufficient data to persuade this government to change its mind over what is an exclusionary and regressive policy, in my opinion. On referenda, well, the less said about them, the better at the moment, given the political education of this country. In an ideal world, absolutely something like a change to the voting system should be put to the people. But we need to make sure that we are educating everybody and bringing everybody on the journey and informing them that democracy at all levels really, really does impact on you. So you are better off if you do choose to work with us, have the conversations, even if you spoil your ballot paper, that is still a legitimate vote. and entertains us all greatly at the council, I think, doesn't it?
That's brilliant, Elizabeth. Thank you so much. That was a fantastic conversation. Peter Kellner helping us read the ruins of the results and knowing that there are people like Elizabeth and Caroline out there working this new politics and making it happen, just this feels incredibly, incredibly reassuring, and more power to your elbow and everybody else who's out there. Lots of people on the call tonight were out working, you know, the streets and the meetings really effectively, and it really showed. And I think Compass scrubbed up really well, and its activists and members and supporters scrubbed up really well. And it was a really good, you know, a training lesson for the next, you know, the next big one. And we're going to kind of ramp everything up from there. So thanks very much, Peter, Caroline and Elizabeth and everyone who was on the call tonight. The next podcast will be on 6 p.m. on Tuesday, the 23rd of May, and Francis will be here digging into the world of community organising. So make sure you tune into that. Thanks again to everyone who was here. Thank you for the people who are listening. If you want to join live next time but haven't joined us yet, please do so. We need you to win a good society, and everyone needs a compass to navigate these complex times as ever. So until then, keep hopeful, keep determined and keep going. Good night. Thanks very much. So, if you like what you've heard today and want to be part of a much more equal, democratic and sustainable future, a good society, then visit us at compassonline.org.uk/podcast, and you'll be able to join us live on future calls just like this one. You can tweet me at Neil, N-E-A-L underscore compass, or compass at Compass Office. And if you've enjoyed this week's episode, please give us a rating. It will help us reach more listeners in the future. And it's only fair that they know it's bloody complicated too.